This is the Books and Authors Fantasy Podcast, episode 62. Well, good day and welcome to this episode of the Books and Authors Fantasy Podcast. I'm your host, podcaster, and author of Fun Fantasy Reads, Jamie Davis. This podcast is exactly what the title says it is. It's a show focused on everything to do with fantasy books, whether we're talking about epic fantasy, urban fantasy, swords and sorcery, grimdark, you name it, we've got it here on the show. So expect to find the best and brightest authors from all the various corners of the fantasy book world here joining me for some chats on our books, on writing, on everything we do as authors, hoping to help you connect with your favorite books and writers out there. Let's kick off this episode with my update for the week. I'm excited to finish up my book for authors on audiobook production tips and tricks. That'll be something I'm working on soon, and I'll be happy to get that wrapped up, at least the first draft. I hope to get that to my beta readers soon, some authors I have been working with to give me feedback and I'm sure clues on what I need to rewrite and add to it. That means I'll be starting soon on book 8 of my urban fantasy supernatural paramedic series, Extreme Medical Services. If you like that kind of thing, actually, you can get book 1. It's available for free on all the ebook stores right now, so check that out. As always, if you want more information on what I'm up to, you can do so by visiting my fan group on Facebook, Jamie's Fun Fantasy Readers, or on my website and blog at jamiedavisbooks.com. I always look forward to hearing from you, so you can reach out and contact me, whether it's on social media or over at my website on the contact form over there. I look forward to checking in with you and responding to your messages. Now let's go ahead and get into our author interview for this episode. Before settling down to write fantasy novels, Josiah Bancroft was a poet, a college instructor, a rock musician, and an aspiring comic book artist. When he's not writing, he enjoys recording the Crit-Faced podcast with his authorial friends, drawing the world of the tower, and cooking dinner without a recipe. He lives in Philadelphia with his wife Sharon and their daughter Maddie, along with their two rabbits, Mabel and Chaplin. So check out this interview with Josiah. We talk about his Books of Babel series, which was a lot of fun for me to read. I think you'll enjoy this interview with Josiah coming right up. Josiah, I want to welcome you to the Books and Authors Fantasy Podcast. It's great to have you on the show today.
It's a pleasure to be here, Jamie. Thank you for having me.
So let's start off with letting you introduce yourself to the readers and audience out there. Tell us a little bit about your background.
Sure. So I am at the moment working as a full-time writer on the Books of Babel Fantasy Adventure series. I just released the third book in the series in January. That was called The Hod King. The first book is called Sinless Sins. The second book is called Arm of the Sphinx. And so that's the first three books in what will be a four-book series. I'm working on the final book now, which is occupying all my time, except I also have a young daughter. She is a toddler. She's 16 months old. And if I'm not working on the books, I'm trying to keep her from hurling herself down the stairs or eating something off the floor. So last year I was a stay-at-home dad full-time, which was wonderful. It was a very rewarding experience. Before that, I had worked as a college instructor in reading and writing and also as a learning lab coordinator at Cecil College.
Yeah, and we were talking before we started recording that I actually teach in the nursing program there. So it's kind of interesting that we had that connection. It's a small world when you think about these ways absolutely. You run into each other or have passed in the night, sort of.
Yeah, it's wonderful. And I think that just by having that as a commonality, we both have an appreciation for the function of community colleges and what they do to serve communities and especially communities that are sometimes overlooked or, have a certain need. And I take that as a real signal of, personal values. And so that is very awesome. I liked it a lot.
Yeah, it's the community colleges are often, like you said, overlooked, but I think they really are in a unique position to help people on so many levels, whether it's for a degree program or a certificate program or in a trade program. There are just so many different ways that they meet communities' needs. And I think they're often, underappreciated, I guess, would be the way to put it, that for what they offer.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I, one of my favorite things about working in the community college atmosphere, the environment, and I would completely consider returning one day, is that often you have these continuing education students who come to you with all the motivation. And as somebody who taught at a traditional university, 18, 19-year-olds who are coming out of high school who sometimes lacked that motivation, it was wonderful to have somebody come in and be like, I need your help, And I was like, hey, I can help you. That's a good sort of relationship to be in.
Yeah, it's interesting. When I went back to get my paramedic degree and then my nursing degree, I had originally had a bachelor's degree in journalism, and I compared the two experiences and they were completely different. I was glad I had the education I got in my bachelor's degree program, but I appreciated the effort and intensity I put into my two other degrees much more, partly because I was paying for it. But the other part of it was
a big difference.
It is a big difference. But the other part of it was I appreciated the knowledge that I was getting and the opportunity that I had, much more, coming in at the age of 35.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And I was a famously terrible student in my college years. I failed out of several programs, and I had to get my grades up at a community college up in the Philadelphia area. And, so at that age, I was in my mid-20s at that point, having messed around for a while. I learned very early on, the community college really served this different function that I benefited from. They helped me kind of get back on my feet after a few missteps. I was not the best student. I had a great time. I started out as I was going to be a computer programmer, a computer science major. But then I learned very quickly that it apparently involves math and computers, which are a bummer. And so, then I became an art major, which was great. I really enjoyed dyeing my hair and not showing up for class. And then for some reason, I got kicked out. it wasn't my fault. So that's when I went to community college and kind of bounced back and, went on to get an English degree somewhere.
That's awesome, though. So the English degree was a happy accident, or had you always been interested in writing?
I had always been interested in writing. When I was growing up, I was a poor reader, but an avid writer. I know that's just completely backwards, but I was the kind of reader who would pick up an adventure novel and just read the dialogue. I thought, you can get the gist of what's happening if you just skip all the narrative blocks and just go to anything in quotation marks has got to be interesting. And so I was a terrible.
Hey, that's how I read Tolkien. That's how everybody reads Tolkien, I think. But anyway,
Terry Brooks and David Eddings and Tolkien the minute I started reading anything, I was like, I can do this. I'm gonna do this better. I can do this right now. And so I started writing my first fantasy novel when I was 12 years old. Unlike, I think, a lot of kids who kind of picked that up, I just stuck with it. And so I went through different phases where I thought I was going to be a poet or sort of a, literary kind of writer or something. I was going to write short stories for The New Yorker at one point. And then after about 35 years of not enjoying writing, kind of pretending that I was going to do something I didn't necessarily like, I came back to fantasy. And that was when I started working on Sinless Sins. So it was sort of a long way to go to come back and be like, this thing that had originally captured my imagination and inspired me has actually got a lot of potential and a lot of opportunity to really tell an interesting story.
And I have to admit, I Senlin Ascends and the Books of Babel, I've just started reading it, is unlike anything I've read before. And being a person who had a history minor in my original degree, I love the connection to this modernized world of, the land of Ur growing up and coming up in the world and continuing on beyond its early ancient roots.
Well, you know, it's funny. It's it sounds like we have like some of the very, you know, similar interests. When I was very young, I was homeschooled, and what that meant for me was my parents just allowed me to study the things that I had any interest in. And I really liked antiquity and sort of the you know, proto nations, and so I would read a lot about the Assyrians and the Hittites and the Sumerians and all that stuff just sort of percolated in my imagination for years and years. But then at the same time, I was reading like, you know, Jules Verne and H.G. Wells. And so when I sat down to write Song of the Sins, I decided not to be anything but like honest about what my fascinations are. And so I kind of like was able to get rid of some of the pretense that had haunted me through my, you know, graduate degree when I was trying to write the great American novel, you know, and I was just like just write about what you're interested in. And I was like, well, I like blimps, you know, I like sort of Victorian fops. I guess I'll write about that. And I also, you know, I like Babylonians. So I just threw it all together, and that's I think that's why it's so odd. It's just it's sort of just a smorgasbord of my own fascinations.
It's and like I said, that's why I think it's unlike anything I've read before. I mean, people either are writing in a you know, I write a lot of urban fantasy, so it's very typical modern world setting. I don't have to do a lot of description. People know what a cell phone looks like. but you know, and or if you created your own world entirely, then you have to do a lot of description. And here you have taken this thing that we kind of know about. I mean, people have at least heard of the Tower of Babel. And so they have this concept in their brain, if only from a biblical sense. And they come up and see your interpretation of it and the culture and the world that's been built around it is fascinating to me. How did you arrive at the whole concept of the tower being built up of rings of different kind of kingdoms? You call them ringdoms.
Yeah, boy, there's like a really stupid honest answer,
well,
and then like
stupid honest answers work. I mean,
well, I mean, I really wanted to have. I had struggled to finish novels my entire life. The novel that I had finished before Sinless Sins was The Quest for Mordo Angus, which I wrote between the ages of 12 and 15. That was about a dragon and was like 250,000 words long. It was, you know, dreadful and all that sort of. But that was the last novel I'd finished. I had written this long sort of parade of abandoned, half-cooked books, and it just got to a point where I was like, there's something wrong with how I'm approaching this. And so one of the reasons that I structured the tower as I did is I was like, if I give myself novelty, if I just bake in novelty that requires me to change the sort of circumstance of each section in a really, like, you know, notable way, it'll keep me from getting bored or distracted. Does that make sense? And so in some ways, it was just a decision before I came up with all the excuses of why it was a wonderful aesthetic decision. It was a decision just to keep me from wandering away from the project, which is what I was always good at.
You know, there's nothing wrong with that. In fact, my first book was about a paramedic who treats supernatural creatures. So I, you know, worked with what I knew, and I built in my love of fantasy and werewolves and vampires and mummies and everything like that. But I wrote it very much in a scene by scene basis. So it's a collection of ambulance calls that are strung together with an overarching storyline that I then wrote around them. And, you know, it turned into much more as the world continued to grow. But initially, it was a collection of 10 premises for ambulance calls and the types of creatures those ambulance calls might be for.
Yeah, and I think that's like very familiar as an experience that you when you start out, you have sort of a vision, but you have a sense of what you're doing. But it's not until like you have put one foot in front of the other for a period of time that things really come into relief. And so, you know, sometimes the humble sort of seed really does, like, you know, the acorn becomes the oak tree sort of thing. And that's it's interesting to hear that your creative process is not that dissimilar.
Yeah. And you know, and it literally came about from, all right, he's off his shift now. What does he do when he goes home?
Right.
And it, 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 it developed actually my method for overcoming what a lot of people call writer's block. And it, for me, it was, I've termed it make a sandwich, because literally I was in a room in a kitchen and I didn't know what to do next. So I had the character make a sandwich. Mm-hmm. And by the end of that sandwich, something happened and he had to go on and do something else. And I cut the sandwich later, but
Right. You don't need the sandwich in the final cut, but you need the sandwich to get there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I've very much, that's been my writing style ever since, is if I get stuck, I do the next mundane thing that a character would automatically do, whether it's cross the room and open that door or whatever.
That's a wonderful technique. And I think, I don't know, it's wonderful that you have something that clear that you can return to. I still feel like every time I start a new chapter, it's like, all right, so how do we do this? Like what was working before? Like, I still find writing to be an endless challenge, which kind of makes it fun. And it kind of makes it disappointing because in some ways it's like, you know, I go to the gym every day and I'm just not getting any stronger. It's just it's like, I still got noodle arms and spaghetti legs. And so sometimes I feel a little frustrated, but the truth is I think like as many sort of tricks and techniques as I've developed over the years, they just don't work forever. And, you know, I have to kind of reinvent the wheel. It feels like right regular.
Yeah. For me, I think it's really, it's not about the sandwich. It's about the trick that fools my brain into starting to write anything.
Sure, yeah.
And you know, within 10 minutes of describing the sandwich to its nth detail, I have suddenly got into that flow state where the story starts again. And for me, that works most frequently. Not all the time, frequently.
I think that's wonderful. Like what I've been using recently is sort of backstory as sort of a primer for the pump, you know, just get me my like session going. And I have totally fallen into backstories many times. There was several occasions in the last book where I wrote 15, 20, 30 page backstories that just had to be like axed. And there's one that I was just so like enamored with. I just decided to, you know, publish it on my website because I just couldn't bear that it not, I was like, I'm really proud of this. This is a really good backstory. No, it doesn't really add anything to the story. No, no one's going to care, but I like it. You know, and so sometimes those sandwiches, those exercises, I think do have their own value, even if they don't end up in the final cut.
And to be honest with you, those are the types of things your most loyal readers will just, you know, crave. I honestly know a couple of authors that use that type of content as gifts for their Patreon subscribers.
See, these are rational people who have functioning sort of business minds. I feel bad charging people for books. You know, it's so funny. I wish I had that bone in my body that was in any way able to. I've never done a Patreon. I've never figured out how to do it, like, you know, Kickstarter. Actually, I'm sort of contributing to a Kickstarter now for the first time for another podcast that I'm on. That's a Dungeons and Dragons sort of author podcast, and I've never done one of these things before. And it's really been interesting to listen to other authors say, like, no, you have tiers of rewards, and this is how you get your fans excited. And I'm like, this is all just crazy talk. Are you sure this stuff works? You know, I'm so terrible that side of things, but I got to learn.
Well, I mean, even if you give it away to a newsletter list, I mean, I honestly think, as even as a reader myself, I would love to have that insight into the backstory that the author has come up with for a character or a scene or a city or whatever. You know, it's the reason that all the other books around The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, all right, those other books were written, and why people that are really into Tolkien crave them, because right, they explain everything else.
Yeah. No, it makes total sense when you're explaining it about someone else's work. I mean, that makes sense. But when you turn the mirror back to me, I'm like, nah. But, you know, like I said, occasionally I'll write something and just I can't let go. I can't just let it fall into a sad folder and a subfolder of a folder on my computer. You know, you're like, this should just be out in the day.
Yeah, 1 year, about 4 years ago, I published my NaNoWriMo chapters as I wrote them. So every night,
wow.
I uploaded that day's work for 30 days. And wow. It still exists on my blog, and it's horrendous. I mean, you know, I ran it through a corrector, you know, like a Grammarly type thing, and you know, and just let it then put it up there. And I, you know, at the beginning of it, it says this is a rough draft, warts and all, but this gives you an idea of this particular story that has yet to be completed. But it is it is the beginning of my epic fantasy opus that
right.
I have just let sit there. I have it drafted. I have it scripted out and plotted. I just have to sit down and write the damn thing.
Well, you know, that's where the rubber meets the road. And I would never show. I don't show my lovely wife, who is so supportive and very interested. I don't show her my drafts. Like I would sooner streak naked across the Super Bowl field than I would post drafts, because I that seems very brave to me.
It is brave, except that you live in Philadelphia, so it's not. You know, for your average Philly sports fan, that would be nothing.
No, that's true. That's true. I think it's brave of you to like be publishing the drafts as you write them. I feel like at the end of every day that I have produced more in the pile of the draft, I do not feel good about myself. I'm like, well, that's over. Let's do something else. We'll fix it later. But it always comes out wrong and backward. And usually what I'm doing in my revision is removing all of the sort of obnoxious pretense or the repetition or the things that just remove like any of the magic from I feel like my books are sort of a magic trick that rely heavily upon just sort of obscuring basic things. But the drafts are so, I don't know, they're clumsy and charmless. And I need at least 7 revisions before I would show that to a living soul.
Wow.
Like,
and everybody has their own process. I mean, it literally stems back to when, I mean, I've been a podcaster since 2005, since the very early days. And I got over myself in that respect early, because the early podcasts I wrote but the early podcasts that I did are horrendous. You know, from a sound quality, from a content quality, and about, you know, I was talking to myself, you know, for hours on end, you know, episode after episode after episode. And I found that I stopped caring what people yep. thought, because yeah. I couldn't, if I let it bother me that I only had, you know, 20 subscribers at the end of the first 6 months, you know, it would bother me. But, right. you know, years later, I've built that up and have started more podcasts and closed off other podcasts and developed all kinds of following in different genres and spaces. And I think that's why I was able to do that, honestly, is I said, you know what? I know this is a draft. I'm going to tell them it's a draft. So nobody can hold me to hold my feet to the fire and say, this is awful. And I'm going to say, well, of course it is. It says it's awful at the very beginning of each chapter.
Yeah, I think that what you're describing is somebody who has a great sense of maturity and perspective. I have neither of those.
Excuse me, I'm glad we're recording this. I want to play that back for my wife later.
Well, I'm just saying, like you are able to articulate like the reality that you know you're in a process. I just feel like I don't like sharing my process. I don't like describing my process. I don't want anyone to see my process, you know, because it's just it's sort of like I think that the phrase you get over yourself is one that I should just tape to my mirror in the bathroom, because it really is this sort of unnecessary vanity. But I mean, I just can't.
You know what? And I tell you this because it's part of my process, not because I think it should be part of yours. And I'm sure you've done this too. Yeah. And for every writer that comes to me and says, you know, tell me what the best way to do this is. And I say to them the same thing. Talk to 100 people, pull the things you think that'll work for you, and throw everything else away, because there's no one way to write a book.
I completely agree with that. I absolutely. The only sort of stipulation that I have given myself in this whole process is you got to write pages. They can be bad pages. They can be stupid pages. You can delete these pages. Like, these are not published pages. You can make goofy mistakes, but you got to write pages. And that's pretty much – that's my credo. And I think one of the reasons that I had that sort of sense of, you know, freedom to do that is I just don't share it. And that way, like, if I'm like, all right, you know what? I'm just going to explore the idea of, like, elves. I know I haven't mentioned elves in Babel before, but let's just do a chapter with elves. And, you know, like,
dude,
I write
that. There could
that.
Be a whole ring full of elves. That's you where know, the elves are. That's why they aren't anywhere else.
See, these are the thoughts that I have. and then I write the stupid thing, and I'm like, oh, wow, that's awful. And then I get rid of it. And so, I mean, like, that's sort of like the liberty that I've had to do exploratory sort of work and writing has come from being a little bit coy and secretive, I think.
No, that's great. And I, you know, it's funny the way you come about this idea of the different rings and the different levels, you know, gives you that freedom. As you said, it was maybe a crutch early on, but I think it's Absolutely. Become one of the most endearing parts of this series to me, is that there are these, I'm waiting to see what the next thing is. Right. Senlin is an interesting character, and I'm curious, you know, how you said the Victorian fop, you know, is that how you picture him?
Not really. I mean, when I first like started with him, he was, I think, a little bit more cardboard, but very quickly with the drafts, he developed a lot more dimension. I wanted somebody who was very well read, but not experienced. And I wanted somebody who was vain and conceited, but unaware of his vanity. And I think that that combination makes for a very interesting sort of vulnerability. And so that really, for me, like, is what characterizes Senlin for at least the first book. And then he begins to change. But the other thing I wanted somebody who was flawed. I wanted somebody who had, you know, legitimate problems and deficits, so that he could learn and grow. I think that one of the things I did not like about fantasy, and I stopped reading fantasy, I think probably in late high school, is I just got tired of these sort of very facile flaws, you know, where the character's problem was they just didn't believe they were chosen, or, you know, they just were too strong. Or, like, you know, like, people didn't understand their genius. I'm like, these are not flaws. This is imaginary stuff. And so Senlin really was somebody that I wanted to begin by making him have a need. Like, he needed to change. He needed to grow. And so the series really is like, it torments him to force him to change and grow. And I think that's been, reflects my own experience in life.
Well, and you know, it's interesting how you describe him, because it's hilarious looking back at the beginning of the book, when he is so sure of himself, because, hey, he has the guide. You know, he's read the definitive work on right. this structure. He knows all about it. And
he's taught courses on it. He's taught classes.
Yeah, and so, you know, when he gets there and just gets smacked in the face with the complete opposite nature of the reality that he's facing, to what he is expected on his his honeymoon trip to this place.
Yeah, you know, that's for me. I sympathize with that experience. I don't know how you experience life, but that pretty much describes what I was like when I was 24. You know, there's that sense of like, I get it. No, you don't have to tell me anything else about life. I've got this. And then by the time I was 30, I was like, I have no idea what's happening. I feel confused. I feel like I've been thrown in a bag and just hitting with sticks for like the last 5 years. Like, I need some help. And so I think that that's part of the inspiration for all that comes from.
Well, I'm the guy that went back to school and got 2 degrees in the middle of my life because I needed to reinvent myself. And, you know, I was a stay-at-home dad for most of my kids' lives.
Oh, that's awesome.
You know, and you know, so I raised them with my wife. My wife had the job with the good benefits and everything. So I stayed home. And from the time our youngest was born, our middle child was born, all the way through them going away to college. So it's been... you know, in that time frame, I started doing things at night to get me out of the house, and that's how I found out I loved medicine.
Huh.
So.
So that stage you're talking about of getting out of the house, that sounds interesting. Talk more about how do you do that? Because right now I'm in the Sharon, my wife, is like, you've got to go out and do something not about babies. Something good at Target, get diapers. No, no, no. Not about babies.
Yeah, well, I needed adult conversation so bad.
Yeah.
And what I – you know, what happened – and then I got inspired. When I was 18, I was in a really bad car accident, and I lived in a rural community in central Maryland. So the volunteer fire department were the ones that cut me out of the car and took me to the helicopter, and they flew me to Baltimore. And a lot of these people were people I knew. I mean, the chief officer on the scene was the janitor at my high school.
Wow.
You know, I mean, so these were just ordinary everyday people who took time out of their lives to go out and serve their community in such a visceral way and such an important way. And so I had kind of said, you know, I'm going to do that. I'm going to give back. I'm going to find a way. So, you know, I kind of forgot about it until I was living in a rural community and needed to get out of the house and happened to be driving past the fire department. And there was that sign that said volunteers needed. And I went, huh. So I showed up on that Monday night, you know, when they had the volunteers to show up and get the information. And I never looked back. I went on and got a degree, you know, got my training as an EMT, started riding the ambulance. I didn't really like the fire trucks that much, so I drifted into the ambulance side.
Right.
And I just, you know, I said, I can be a paramedic. I can get a degree and do that. And then somebody said, you treat your patients the way a nurse treats your patients. You should go to nursing school. So I went and did that. But that all progressed from me sitting there going, all right, I'm going to be the guy that gets up in the middle of the night and rides the ambulance from like 7 until 4 in the morning because I have to be back in time for my wife to go to work.
When did you sleep?
Well, they don't run calls all night. So okay. I'd take a duty crew shift probably, you know, like two nights a week. And then I'd be on call with my pager if like they needed a second ambulance the other nights, I would get called out. So we only at the time ran 3 to 4 calls a day.
Okay.
So I only got called out of bed, you know, a couple times a week.
It still sounds like I feel like if somebody said, would you like an extra $1,000 a week or 5 more hours of sleep? I'd be like, sleep. I'm going to sleep. I want the 5 hours of sleep.
You know, it was something I was passionate about, so I didn't mind rolling out. And there were days when I was dog tired because, you know, it was those rare nights where I ran back-to-back calls for 6 hours. And
oh boy.
But it also led to me having the epiphany one night in the middle of the night when I had this really hairy vagrant guy in the back of the ambulance. And I just kind of joked to my partner after we unloaded him at the hospital. I said, hey, that guy was like a werewolf, wasn't he? And literally, I can trace the storyline of my first series back to that moment, because that was where I started kind of fantasizing and thinking about, oh, I wonder what kind of mythical creature this person is.
Yeah, I love that. That's wonderful. And it began with, I got to get out of the house. You know, I this has been inspiring. I may have to get out of the house sometime.
Well, you know, and there's all kinds of things you can do. There are volunteer opportunities that don't involve going to the firehouse. I mean, there are opportunities to help out and all sorts of things in the evening or overnight hours once or twice a week or once or twice a month. That'll, you know,
absolutely
give you that opportunity. So, I want to wrap up. I have a feeling you and I can talk forever.
Yeah, unexpectedly, we have a lot in common. That's wonderful. I really, really enjoyed talking.
But I want to make sure we cover the bases here. Where can folks find you online? Because as we're wrapping up here, I want to make sure that people know how to find your books and find you and find those you know, those back chapters that you might be hiding on your website.
Yeah, if you go to my website, it's www.thebooksofbabel.com. I have examples of my artwork. I have links to the books if you're interested in buying either the physical ebooks or the audiobook versions of the series. I have the extra chapter that we talked about. There's lots of different things that people can see. They can sign up for my newsletter, and they can message me with questions if they have any. I'm always happy to receive those. I'm not really on much social media right now, but I'm on Twitter at Bancroft Josiah. I realize that's not ideal, but I tend to delete my social media about once a year, and so that's what I could get this last time I reemerged from the burrow. So that's about it.
Awesome. Well, we will make sure that there are links to both your books and your website and your erstwhile social media presence in the show notes for this episode. And, you know, Josiah, I'd love to have you back on. You're working on book four now. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. I'm slaving away on book four and making progress. So, yeah, that's where I'm at.
When are you thinking that'll come out? You have any thoughts?
I don't know. Okay. Like right now, like I'm pretending like it still might be next year. But between you, me, and the podcasting universe, I just don't know. My goal with a final book is to make it right, not to make it quick. So
understood. And hey, you've got a toddler that occupies a good bit of your time. I know.
She's a wonderful human and a terrible editor.
Well, Josiah, thanks for coming on the show. We'll want to have you back and talk to you again in the future for sure.
Sounds wonderful. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
And that's going to wrap up this episode of the Books and Authors Fantasy Podcast. Make sure you catch up with us for a whole lot more from the fantasy-focused community, both on Facebook and over at fantasy-focus.com. Leave a comment on this episode. Let me know what you think about and what's on your mind. I'd love to hear from you. Also, when you're over at the website at fantasy-focus.com, make sure you check out the podcast episode posts and figure out right there below the player at the top of the page that you can subscribe to the show. That's right. Whether you're on an iOS device, an Android device, even if you want to subscribe by email, you can do so. Just click the links right there and they'll walk you through a simple process to get that done. We have some pretty awesome authors coming up soon, so you'll want to be subscribed. We've got Stephen Landry coming up in the next episode, which was a lot of fun. You definitely don't want to miss that one. That's it for this episode of the Books and Authors Fantasy Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Jamie Davis, author of Fun Fantasy Reads. Don't forget to follow me over on Facebook at Jamie Davis Books and at my website, jamiedavisbooks.com, where you can get a free book if you want, check out my writing, and sign up for the newsletter over there. Whatever you do, though, subscribe. Come back here for the next podcast. And in the meantime, please remember, people, I tell you every week, you got to keep your eyes open because there's magic all around you.